This episode is provided by Thomas Allgaier and Frenis, based on the most relevant LinkedIn posts about channel marketing in calendar weeks 13 and 14. Frenis is a B2B market research partner helping ICT and tech providers identify niche channel partners by compressing the full journey from identification to qualified first meeting into 4 to 5 weeks. You can find more info in the description. So, what if I told you that sending your partners like expensive swag and earning a perfect sentiment score is actually the fastest way to get your partnership program completely shut down?
I mean, it's a harsh reality to wake up to for sure.
Yeah.
But that is exactly what the data is pointing toward right now.
Yeah.
Today, our mission is to distill a massive amount of industry noise into actionable intelligence. We're unpacking the top channel marketing trends we've seen across LinkedIn over the last couple of weeks.
Right. And specifically, we're doing this to help you, the B2B marketing professionals listening, turn your partner ecosystems into, well, actual scalable revenue engines.
Exactly. So if you're listening to this right now and you are, you know, struggling to prove the ROI of your partner programs,
which so many are right
now. Absolutely. Or if you're feeling the massive pressure of AI kind of shifting your go-to-market strategies underneath your feet, consider this your survival guide. This entire deep dive is built on real-time insights from industry leaders who are in the trenches today.
So let's start right at the foundation, because before we even look at campaigns or technology, we really have to look at how partnerships are fundamentally structured.
Right.
When you read through the source material from these past 2 weeks, it becomes painfully obvious that most programs are, well, they're built to fail the minute they try to scale.
Yeah, it's the classic scaling trap. Kyle E. shared a brilliant framework on LinkedIn recently about the three stages of an ecosystem. He breaks it down into initiation, momentum, and control.
Okay, so walk us through those. Initiation is first.
Yeah, stage one initiation is almost entirely founder-led. Deals get done purely on trust, high energy, and, you know, the founder's personal reality distortion field.
Right, just sheer force of will.
Exactly. Then you hit stage two, momentum. You get up to maybe 60 partners, revenue starts following, leadership declares this massive victory, and they just double the headcount.
Which, on the surface, sounds like a total success story. But that momentum is actually a mirage, right? Because then they hit stage three.
Yeah, stage three is the control stage. And this is where Kyle points out that most programs completely die.
Wow. Why is that?
Because moving to control requires process, it requires governance, and deep data infrastructure. But nobody built any of that during the first two stages. They just relied on relationships.
Ah, I see. So the trust that closed deals early on doesn't magically transfer to the newly hired partner managers.
Nope. The founder steps back to focus on other things, the personal connection evaporates, and the whole system just sort of stalls out.
And what's crazy is that companies are throwing money at this broken system without fixing the underlying plumbing. Gail Calvert pointed out that 69% of B2B tech companies actually plan to increase their partnership investment moving forward.
Right, but the results just don't match the intention.
Because of that exact infrastructure gap, they have no prioritization frameworks, they have like no joint messaging that actually converts buyers, and most fatally, no pipeline cracking that a CFO would ever trust.
Which perfectly leads us to the harsh truth of partner management today. Rob Moyer posted something that I think, honestly, every partner manager needs to print out and put on their wall.
Oh yeah, the swag post.
Yes. He described the partner manager everyone loves, you know, the one who sends the best swag, remembers everybody's birthdays, and boasts these perfect net promoter scores from their partners.
They show up to the quarterly business review with like 50 slides of relationship health, green check marks everywhere.
Right, partner logos all over the place. And then the chief revenue officer asks the only question that matters, where is the revenue? And the pipeline is completely empty.
It's brutal.
It is. Moyer says you have to stop measuring sentiment. Relationships are inputs. Closed revenue is the output. You cannot just optimize the input, call it a day, and think you've done your job.
Yeah, and Sukriti Cha echoed that exact sentiment, noting that partner programs without a crystal clear link to pipeline just become low impact activity centers. They look busy, but they generate zero commercial value.
Exactly. Activity does not equal achievement.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit, because I want to push back on the industry behavior here. If everyone functionally knows revenue is the only metric that matters, why are leaders still so deeply distracted by badges and swag and sentiment?
It's human nature, really.
I mean, to me, it's like running a marathon, but only tracking how many high fives you got along the route instead of your actual pace. Why do we keep counting the high fives?
Because high fives are incredibly easy to count. and pace is painfully hard to improve.
That is a great point.
It is much easier to control your swag distribution and run a bi-weekly sync call than it is to orchestrate a complex, multi-stakeholder co-sell motion that actually closes a deal.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But that brings us to an interesting, somewhat counterintuitive perspective from Pablo Hano regarding how we structure these ecosystems to actually drive that revenue.
Okay, what does he suggest?
Well, the current trend of the industry is to ruthlessly cut the long tail and only focus your energy on the top 10% of producing partners.
Right, the classic go deep, not broad advice. Cut the dead weight.
Exactly. But Hano argues that treating your ecosystem like an exclusive VIP club is actually a lazy strategy. He uses this great ice cream shop analogy.
I love a good food analogy. Let's hear it.
If you walk into an ice cream shop and they only have three flavors, chocolate, strawberry, vanilla, you instinctively think, wow, this place is really limited. But if they have 25 flavors, you might still just order chocolate, but you leave happy because of the perception of choice and ecosystem strength.
Oh, that's clever.
Yeah, depth works precisely because breadth exists.
That makes a lot of sense. You need the full menu to validate the core offerings. But wait, how do you manage those 25 flavors without bankrupting your enablement resources?
Well, you need depth for today, meaning joint go-to-market motions, heavy investment, and deal inspection for your top VIP partners. But you need breadth for tomorrow.
So you don't cut the long tail.
No, you just stop treating them like the top tier. You handle the long tail with scalable, product-led activation and self-service enablement so they can grow at their own pace without eating up your operational bandwidth.
Okay, so if we agree that revenue is the true north and we actually have the infrastructure to handle both the VIPs and the self-serve long tail, we hit the next major roadblock.
Right.
Why are the partners who are actively in the system still failing to sell? Which takes us directly into the gap between what we give partners and what they actually need. It's an enablement trap.
It really is an enablement trap. Tony Poer from 8x8 had a phenomenal insight here. He said, enablement isn't failing because of a lack of information.
Because they have too much, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Partners have more portals, PDFs, and battle cards than they could ever possibly read. Enablement is failing because of a lack of translation.
What does translation mean in the specific context?
It means vendors are handing over static feature walkthroughs, like, here is what our software does.
Yeah.
But that falls flat because it doesn't translate your product into the partner's specific sales motion.
Ah, I see.
The partner's sales rep doesn't care about your features. They care about how your product fits into the overarching solution they are pitching to their specific buyer. If you don't translate your feature into their sales narrative, the PDF just sits in a portal gathering dust.
Right. And Craig Booth from Channel Force calls this the long tail problem. You look at your partner dashboard, you celebrate that you have like 100 enrolled partners, but you realize only 5% are actually out there hunting for deals.
Yeah, massive drop off.
His solution to this is fascinating, though. He applies the Medic sales framework, but not to the end customer. He applies it to the partner sellers themselves.
That is a crucial psychological shift. For those listening who might not use it daily, MEDIC stands for Metrics, Economic Buyer, Decision Criteria, Decision Process, Identify Pain, and Champion.
It's basically a standard framework for qualifying enterprise deals.
Exactly. But Booth says, stop just using it on the end user. Treat the partner seller as your customer.
So you have to uncover the partner seller's personal ROI.
Precisely. What is their personal metrics or identify pain? Usually it's their commission check or, you know, hitting their quarterly quota.
Right.
If you don't use Medic to connect your product directly to their personal financial win, they simply will not sell it, no matter how glossy your enablement PDF is. Your product isn't the software to them. Your product is their commission.
Wow. And shifting that mindset goes beyond just sales frameworks. Elisaveta Shalagina talks about winning mindshare in incredibly crowded distributor environments by shifting from a vendor to a knowledge partner.
I really liked her take on this.
Yeah, instead of just pushing product updates on a weekly call, she suggests providing upskilling as a service. So, for example, running advanced Google Ads training for your partner's marketing teams.
She also advocates for radical transparency as part of that upskilling. Like literally sharing the real learning curves of your own internal marketing campaigns.
Which is a bold move.
It is. Walking into a partner meeting and saying, here's what we tried last quarter, here's what completely failed, and here's what actually worked.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, though. If we practice this radical transparency and actively share our campaign failures with partners, as Elisaveta suggests, doesn't that make us look a bit I don't know, incompetent. I mean, we're the vendor. We're supposed to be the experts with everything figured out.
It's a completely natural fear.
Mm.
But it ignores the fundamental psychology of reciprocity.
How so?
When you show vulnerability and say, hey, we lost $50,000 trying X, so we are sharing this so you don't have to make the same mistake, you are saving them tangible risk. You aren't just a vendor pushing a product anymore. You are a mentor protecting their business.
Oh, wow.
That builds an impenetrable level of trust that no amount of swag could ever buy.
That makes total sense. And you can really contrast that level of trust with the sheer awkwardness of what Von Mordecai pointed out regarding co-branding. He calls out the same content, different logo strategy.
Oh, that is the worst.
It is. You have competing partners in the same region sending the exact same generic asset to the exact same prospect. The buyer looks at it and thinks, why are three different IT providers sending me identical brochures? It completely undermines the partner's unique value proposition.
Which is exactly why executing partner marketing mechanically is so incredibly difficult right now. Lucy Harvey shared some fascinating first-party intent data from S2W Media on this.
What did they find?
They tracked thousands of intent signals across the web and found that 56% of channel teams are actively researching how to execute partner marketing mechanics.
Wait, really? Mechanics, not strategy.
Exactly. They aren't researching high-level strategy. They are literally Googling how to get the mechanics of these campaigns out the door. Driving actual reseller engagement remains the single biggest hurdle in the industry.
And if you're sitting at headquarters, Francesca Bortop points out that your HQ strategies often fail because they completely ignore local market retail realities.
Oh, the disconnect is huge.
HQ thinks a campaign that works in North America will just magically scale to Europe or Asia, completely ignoring local promotional calendars, cultural buying habits, and partner priorities.
It creates massive friction.
Yeah.
Shweta Jade actually highlighted this exact misalignment between partner marketing and enablement, noting that blurring the lines between what HQ wants to say and what local enablement actually needs to do harms the entire ecosystem.
So let's say you fix all of that. You nail the infrastructure, you fix the enablement translation gap, you align your global marketing with local sales, and your partners are fully armed.
Okay, best case scenario.
You still have to meet the buyer where they are. And right now, the buyer is fundamentally shifting how they procure software. We are moving rapidly away from isolated one-off vendor deals and entering the era of the hyperscaler marketplace.
It's the biggest shift in B2B procurement in a decade.
Without a doubt.
Chip Rogers referenced a conversation with Google Cloud's Rajiv Batra that perfectly encapsulates this ecosystem convergence.
Yeah.
The best co-sell motions today aren't just vendor plus partner walking into a room.
Who else is coming to the room?
They're bringing an entire ecosystem. So ISVs, which are independent software vendors, alongside GSIs, global systems integrators, all collaborating to solve a specific industry problem. They are replacing static PowerPoint pitches with live integrated demos, showing how three different software platforms work seamlessly together on the cloud.
But the rules of engagement with these hyperscalers like AWS, Google, Microsoft, they are brutal. Neha Agarwal dropped a serious reality check for anyone trying to partner with them.
What did she say?
She said traditional certifications and partner tiers are essentially dead noise now. Having a gold badge might get you in the room, but the hyperscaler field teams only care about two things. Are you creating or closing ACE pipeline, which is AWS customer engagements, their internal deal tracking? Mm-hmm. And are you driving actual marketplace transactions?
Yeah, she added a critical point for the coming year too. If you don't have an AI-driven cost reduction story, you are basically invisible to them.
Oh, interesting.
You have to walk in and say, by integrating our solution, this mutual customer automated X process eliminated Y hours of manual work and saved Z dollars. If you can't articulate that specific mechanism of savings, the hyperscaler reps won't give you the time of day because that's what their enterprise buyers are demanding.
And speed is the absolute name of the game here. Eric Hensley noted that Gen AI native offers are shortening procurement cycles by 2 to 3 times on these marketplaces, which is wild. How exactly does that happen?
Because it bypasses the traditional enterprise friction. When a buyer purchases through a hyperscaler marketplace, they're often utilizing pre-committed cloud spend.
Ah, the budget is already approved.
Exactly. They don't have to go through a massive bespoke legal redlining process or a 6-month security review because the vendor has already been vetted by the marketplace. The pricing is standardized, the security is validated, and the transaction is frictionless.
That makes total sense.
Vince Mincione stressed that the top operators in our space are pulling far ahead of the pack. because they treat the marketplace as a core business model, an operating system, not just a neat feature to capture extra budget.
But we do have to balance this marketplace excitement with some really sobering data from Jay McBain. He reported that 58% of partners are forecasting a double-digit profit decline early next year.
Yeah, it's unprecedented margin compression.
Partners are dealing with geopolitical uncertainties, supply chain barriers, and vendors pushing increasingly complex programs with highly restrictive terms. McBain warns that vendors must simplify their programs and proactively protect partner margin, or they risk totally alienating the channel.
Because modern platforms are increasingly optimized to extract value from partners rather than distribute it, and the partners are feeling the squeeze.
So as a vendor, I have to ask, aren't we just trading our old channel problems for a new hyperscaler tax? I mean, you're paying marketplace listing fees, your margins are compressing, you're managing complex multi-partner deals. Is the juice actually worth the squeeze?
It is, if you design your entire operating model around it. Look at Roman Kirsanov's breakdown of Sentinelone's success. They recently passed $1 billion in revenue, and they run a truly partner-dependent model.
Really? Substantially all of it?
Yes. Substantially all of their sales flow through the channel. In some market segments, partners run the entire sales cycle end-to-end. They are deeply integrated across cloud marketplaces and AI services, essentially doing a deep hyperscaler co-build, not just a casual co-sell.
Okay, so they lean all the way in.
Exactly. So yes, there are marketplace fees, but leaning into that model creates massive operational leverage. They can grow revenue exponentially without significantly growing their own internal headcount.
Okay, so you absolutely need massive operational leverage to survive this margin compression and manage these complex multi-partner marketplace deals, and you cannot do that manually.
Definitely not.
Managing thousands of ecosystem interactions using spreadsheets is officially dead. The only way forward is deep data, AI, and RevOps integration, which is the final piece of our analysis today.
Manual management isn't just dead. It's a competitive liability. Will Taylor points out a massive sophistication gap right now. Think about this. Marketing has over 15,000 different tech vendors supporting its operations. Partner tech has maybe 450.
That is a staggering gap in technological maturity, 15,000 to 450.
Yeah. And as AI begins to ingest go-to-market data across the enterprise, this gap is going to widen exponentially. Taylor warns that if ecosystem and partner data isn't deeply integrated into your core RevOps infrastructure, your company's AI models are only going to be trained on volume-based spam from traditional direct sales and marketing.
Right, because that's the only data it has access to.
Exactly. The AI will completely ignore the high conversion, warm partner motions because it literally can't see them.
Keeping partner data out of RevOps is like trying to train a self-driving car but refusing to let it see the actual roads. You're guaranteeing a crash. But if you're listening to this and realizing your data is siloed, how do you practically start this integration tomorrow?
You schedule a meeting with your operations, team RevOps, marketing ops, whoever it is, and you ask exactly what data warehouses and attribution systems they're using.
Okay.
Then you aggressively force your partner data, your co-sell lists, and your ecosystem messaging into every single one of those primary workflows. You have to stop wasting time on siloed partner activities that don't map directly to the core revenue metrics inside those centralized systems.
Because if you don't, your job might literally disappear. Valerie R. Arnon posted a highly provocative thought about what she calls the great hollowing.
Yeah, that post was intense.
It was. She argues that AI is hollowing out traditional alliance roles. If you are listening to this and your primary value as a partner manager is merely coordinating meetings, taking notes, and acting as a human API between two companies' CRM systems, well, that role is dead. You are being replaced by what she calls the monetization catalyst.
A monetization catalyst doesn't just schedule syncs. They leverage data to actively design revenue-generating motions. And we are seeing this shift driven by agentic AI being deployed rapidly right now.
And for context, agentic AI isn't just a chatbot that writes text, right?
Exactly. It's AI that can autonomously take actions across different software systems to achieve a goal. Patrick M. Furtick discussed using this AI to automatically and continuously assess inbound partners against your ideal partner profile.
How does it do that?
It reads their API documentation, checks their market presence, and scores them. No more gut feelings or manual vetting. It's a living, automated framework.
And the hyperscalers themselves are leading the charge on this execution. Mike Dowling, Julia Chen, and Preet Panwar all highlighted AWS's new partner central agents.
Oh, those are fascinating.
Yeah. These AI agents sit inside the portal and provide real-time sales plays, deep customer insights, and even automated funding recommendations directly into the partner's workflow as they are building a deal. It's highly personalized strategic guidance at scale for every single opportunity in the pipeline.
But, and this is the critical caveat, the AI is only as good as the context you feed it. Sugata Sanyal noted that for TSDs, which are technology solutions distributors that aggregate vendor offerings for smaller partners,
right,
AI only works with rich context. If you just use an AI model like a standard search engine, you get generic, useless results.
Yeah.
But TSDs and partners who feed the AI their own proprietary historical deal data are jumping to 95% accuracy in their automated recommendations.
Wow, 95%.
Yeah, it completely shifts their value pitch to the partner from, I can save you some software costs,
yeah,
to, I can fundamentally double your sales team's output. Your proprietary data is your new competitive moat.
It always comes back to the data. Okay, we've covered a massive amount of ground today in this deep dive. We looked at surviving the control stage of scaling. We unpacked how to fix the enablement translation problem using Medic.
We navigated the shift toward hyperscaler marketplaces.
And finally, the absolute necessity of integrating agentic AI and RevOps. If we connect all of these insights into the bigger picture, it raises an important, maybe even slightly terrifying question for everyone listening.
Okay, let's hear it.
Think about your own ecosystem. If agentic AI eventually automates all partner matching based on data, and hyperscaler marketplaces seamlessly handle the complex procurement, legal, and integration steps, does the traditional concept of B2B marketing dissolve entirely?
Oh, wow.
In the near future, you might not be marketing to human buyers at all. Your entire job might just be optimizing your ecosystem data so that a buyer's AI agent automatically selects your solution over a competitor's without a human ever seeing a PDF.
Wow. Optimizing for the algorithm, marketing to the machine. That is a wild paradigm shifting thought to leave on. If you enjoyed this episode, new episodes drop every 2 weeks. Also check out our other editions on account-based marketing, field marketing, AI and B2B marketing, MarTech, go-to-market, and social selling.
Thanks so much for joining us on this deep dive. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you never miss an insight.
Keep optimizing those ecosystems and we will catch you on the next one.